This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. The Trump administration rolling out its deportation agenda in President Trump's first week in office, releasing numbers showing more than 500 arrests made within a 24-hour period following raids in major cities. ABC's Martha Raddatz has more.
ICE raids and arrests in cities across the country, Boston, New York, and Newark, New Jersey. Newark's mayor saying agents raided a small business without a warrant, detaining American citizens in the process.
People were fingerprinted. Pictures of their IDs and face were taken there. When I got this information, I was appalled.
President Trump in Las Vegas today. He'll rally supporters and highlight his campaign promise on ending federal taxes on tips. Growing concerns over bird flu and its impact on egg production. Prices for eggs keep rising due to outbreaks at facilities. This is ABC News. A new scam popping up across the country drains life savings from scared victims. It all starts with a hacked email account and ends up with people handing over their cash or cash bars to the scammers. The victims are told they're part of a government investigation and not to say a word to anybody, not even family members, or risk going to jail. ABC's Nina Pineda talked to Eva Rothman, a victim in Queens, New York.
Mrs. Rothman was manipulated, first into draining her checking account, instructed to place $20,000 in a shoebox, go outside to the street, and wait.
I brought the money down, the box down, a car pulled up.
But it would get much, much worse. The fake agent would then control her into cashing out a recent inheritance. In the space of 1 week, she would take a taxi, go up to the shop, purchase gold bars and gold coins. The grand total, $698,000.
I'm Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Seems everywhere in the state, housing has just gotten so expensive. Our current president ran on promises to help the middle class, and I'd like to know what he's going to do about the housing shortages. I went through the executive orders. I read through the speech transcript a couple of times. Nothing he really said or did in the first couple days has anything to do with helping the middle class.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. One in three kids living in rural areas of Wisconsin is insured by Medicaid, and Congress is considering cutting some of the program's funding. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
The nationwide study from Georgetown University Center for Children and Families used census data to compare how many people living in rural areas are insured by Medicaid. William Park Sutherland with Kids Forward explains northern Wisconsin counties above Highway 29 have higher than average rates of children enrolled.
We really are leveraging our future by targeting a program that not only, but one of its most important roles is protecting the health of kids.
About 1.5 million Wisconsinites are insured through Badger Care, the state Medicaid program. It makes up about 26% of the state budget, providing health care coverage for low-income residents from birth to age 64.
There's just no way to cut out this much of the program, right? $2 trillion, and not hurt children, not hurt seniors, and not hurt people with disabilities who depend on Medicaid along with parents and caregivers.
He says cuts would also risk increasing the number of uninsured people, up the amount of medical debt and financial insecurity in the state, and potentially deter people from seeking care. Wisconsin is one of 10 states that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. A Wisconsin Policy Forum study shows the state could save $1.7 billion over the next 2 years if it did. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny today, highs in the low 30s, slight chance of a light snow shower. It'll be a bit breezy from time to time out of the west. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 7, wind chills slightly below 0. Sunny and 29 for Sunday, but breezy again.
Currently 33 degrees.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
It is the weekend. That means coming up on the show, we'll break down all the news that you might have missed and wrap it up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey there, political orphans. Swing voters, independents, that whole gang. Welcome to special edition of Lost in the Middle. We're going to do a countdown between the middle of September and work our way up till Election Day. And we've sort of switched out the format. This won't be storytelling the way we do things. But instead, what I'm doing is talking to some of the smartest political podcast hosts in the country. But before we go there, I want to tell you a quick story. When I left Congress, it was sort of running up to the 2000 election. And I got a call from a good friend of mine named Brady Williamson. And Brady said, I've got an idea for you. What's that? He said, let's try to get a political debate in Madison because it would be interesting in the 2000 election. And Brady had worked for the Clintons for years and was a Democratic operative. And I said, let's rock and roll. So we reached out to what was then called the Political Debate Commission, which everybody thought was an official arm of the federal government, but instead it was just a cozy room between a longstanding Republican and a longstanding Democratic operative who figured out a way to make money on this. And the deal was you had to raise $500,000 because the presidential debate is a television operation. And so the first thing we had to do was raise, I don't know, I think it was $200,000 to show that we were serious, which actually was much easier than we thought it would be. We had a couple of large Madison businesses step forward, and then some foundations locally, and then we're ready to rock and roll. And then out come the folks who actually scout the presidential debate. And so we wandered around Madison looking for venues. And so the whole Madison community was geeked about the idea. And then they wanted to show off the new Madison Civic Center, which had been designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And they walked in the room, and we probably spent maybe 3.5 minutes in it, because if you've ever seen anything designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, it may be brilliant, but it's weird. And every section we looked, there was a column or a weird thing. Walked out of that, then went to the old Oscar Mayer Theater. Yes, Madison was the home of Oscar Mayer Wieners and the Wienermobile. And they liked that a lot, but it was a really cool old building and would have great angles to look down on the audience and look very ornate and very rich. And then it turned out by the time they built out the stage downstairs, there'd be no time for sitting. So that went out the window. And so we ended up with the Madison Expo Center, which was just basically a big box. So it was a weird year because the Olympics were that fall and the World Series was really late. And so they decided at the end of the day, they're going to have to do all of the four debates, three presidential and one vice presidential, in a very compressed time frame. So we're sitting around like the NFL draft waiting for the phone to ring. And they pick up the phone and say, Brady, Scott, we've got some great news for you. Okay, we want you to host the vice presidential debate. It's like, who the hell watches the vice presidential debate, much less trying to raise $500,000 to stage it? And as we're looking through sort of depressed glasses at one another, they say, here's the date. And they pick a weekend in October in a great Wisconsin story that's not a punchline. It was the World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin. we were off the hook. You could not find a hotel room because people with trailers and pickup trucks were driving their prize Holsteins to Dane County, Wisconsin to show them off. So our prize for doing that was actually we got tickets to go to the presidential debate in Boston. Al Gore and George Bush. The highlight of the night for me personally was that Christie Brinkley sat in front of me with purple, sort of eggplant-colored leather pants. And let's just say it was not a particularly good look. But the defining moment of the debate was Al Gore doing this every time George Bush started to answer a question. And it's literally, graded by historians, is one of the 10 worst debate moments in U.S. presidential history. So we never ended up with the debate here, but we just all watched the debate. And I want to turn around to my guest, Andrew Heaton, who's actually calling us in from Scotland, from a phone booth in a men's businessman club, I take it is, Andrew?
I'm at the Royal Scots Club, which is just a nice, stuffy club that has allowed me to become a member. I like to work out of here, and being a humble boy from Oklahoma, I find it endlessly funny to talk to old British men in three-piece suits. So I come to Scotland to avoid the Texan weather for about a month a year, and then I work out of here.
Well, you can tell by the early introduction. So Andrew actually hosts a podcast much aligned with us called The Political Orphanage. So that means my political orphans actually live in his political orphanage when they turn into his podcast, which is terrific. Mm-hmm. He's been a stand-up comedian. He's performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. He's written a bunch of books, including one that's called Laughter is Better Than Communism. And he actually opened up for William Shatner, who said, wow, that Andrew guy, he's pretty funny. But the cool thing is, and most people won't know this, and I actually know this because my youngest son spent some time in comedy, is you performed with Upright Citizens Brigade in L.A., which is sort of the West Coast version of Second City, who don't know it. So,
yeah, it was New York, but yes, the UCB, it had outposts on both coasts, and I got improvisational training from the good people at UCB. I have a certificate saying I'm funny. I have it on my wall. UCB is a fish. I'm licensed to be funny by UCB.
That's terrific. Worked on the Hill for Tim Holden, who's an old buddy of mine, who was a Democrat from Pittsburgh. We used to play in the congressional baseball game together. And Tim actually had one of the worst moments I've ever seen because he and Bill Jefferson, another Democrat from Louisiana, who later on got sentenced to prison for racketeering, but that's an entirely different story. Tim was at first base. Bill was at catcher. Somebody popped up in the middle of the first base and home plate, and they collided head on. And Steve Largent was playing with us, former NFL football player, who said that was the ugliest collision I've ever seen, worse than anything I'd ever seen in the NFL. And they both, Tim got gashes, Jefferson got teeth knocked out, everything in the world. So now that I've completely wasted everybody's time for 8 or 9 minutes with a story that went nowhere, let's talk about your impressions of the debate. Does it really matter? Did it really change anybody's mind?
Yes, I think they do. So I was very skeptical of the debates up until about 3 months ago. I'm one of these people that is angry at the what had been the Presidential Commission on Debates, because it seemed to me that they were intentionally icing out any third party candidates that would come in, and I was ruffled about that. I was angry that Gary Johnson had approached whatever metric they needed, and then they immediately put it up to 10% in order to ice him out, and was taking the rather cynical view of like, look, everyone in America has made up their mind about Biden and Trump. This is, before Biden dropped out. No one needs any additional information. It's not as if Trump is some sort of coy, opaque figure that we don't know a lot about. And I have changed my tune on that completely. I watched the debate between Biden and Trump, and I had been likewise kind of skeptical about the whole Biden mental acuity thing, because that sounded to me like kind of a made-up Republican talking point. And then I, like much of the rest of the country, watched the president's brains drain out of his ears like motor oil and went, this the apparently they were right about this. We have been gaslit, America. So I thought that the debate did a really good public service at that point. The most recent, so for that reason, I think the debates are good, just because they do allow you to see if somebody's truly crazy or not. I don't think that they're particularly salient for policy discussions, and the latest debate was not salient for policy discussions, but I think that they could be useful in that regard. In terms of pushing people to vote in a particular direction, yes. My understanding is that last-minute voters tend to be disproportionately affected by the personalities they see on display at the debates and by bombardments of advertising that get them the last couple of weeks. So for most people that are plugged into politics, and I would imagine that that's the bulk of your audience, they probably have their own internal compass that they're using and some kind of metric they're using to make decisions in terms of who they're going to vote for that involves ideology and policy goals and character or something to that effect, right? I think there is a group of people, and they're ultimately who's going to determine this election, which are not nearly that attuned to politics. And so for them, they're running a lot of this off of gut feelings and vibes. And in that capacity, I think it's going to really benefit Kamala Harris, because my personal suspicion is I'm telling all the Scots while I'm here, I'm putting it 60-40 on Kamala Trump. I think she's going to take it. It's going to be razor thin, but I think that she's probably going to take it. And my rationale for this is that I think the last minute voters that are not reliably Republican or Democrat are going to basically go, I don't know, I associate Trump with old screamy guys. I don't like that. Let's give this new lady a try. She seems sane. And Kamala did a good job of appearing sane and reasonably normal for the course of the debate. And so I think that that vibe will work to her advantage.
So who's left that hasn't made up their mind?
I think it is the swing, like the truly swing voters, right? So like I'm an independent, and I'm a big critic of the two-party system, and I will kind of join people in breathlessly talking about how wonderful it is that independents are gaining traction and they're now the largest voting bloc. They're larger than Republicans or Democrats. But when you really look at it, the majority of independents, probably about 80%, are reliably Republican or Democratic voters, but they just really don't like the party. And so it's almost like a protest that they're registering as an independent, but they're going to vote Republican or Democrat. That leaves about 20%. And half of those people, I think, are like me, where we are very plugged in, but we have our own aberrant, weird Rorschach test that we're applying to American politics, which means we're not permanently in the pocket of either camp. But I think that there's another group of people that for them, they're living their lives and they're thinking about work and thinking about their kids. And they're not really thinking about politics. And so they're a lot more affected by how they would judge a used car salesman, which is like, does this person seem honest? Does this person seem like they're going to be the person who's going to sell me the right car? Are they going to swindle me? Can they get things done? Are they going to be a good boss? They're going with personality attributes to a great extent. And I think those are the kind of swing voters that will be swayed by the debate.
I think for folks who are political junkies, it's hard to understand. I mean, I keep running into people who say there can't be any undecided voters. They can't be, but there are. And I think people have a hard time comprehending that. And, you know, the interesting thing is if you talk to political consultants, I mean, I spent a bunch of time arguing with Mike Murphy over this idea, whether they're independents or really they're just closet Republicans or closet Democrats. If you talk to the folks at Arizona State and Tom Riley, who runs the only political science department in the country, which has a specific study of independent voters, he'll tell you there are a significant chunk. And if you look, you can see it for yourself. If you look at the vote totals in 2012, they went dramatically for Obama. Then they turned around and shifted to Trump. And then in 20, they shifted around and voted for Clinton. So I do think there's a group that is permanently disengaged with either of the major political parties. But we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Andrew, I want to talk to you about why I think your analysis is wrong on the debate, because I want to tell you the two issues that I think are trouble for Harris.
Great.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance.
We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that protects property owners and their interests. Did you know that in 10 states and Washington, D.C., the government can take more than what it is owed in property taxes in the instance of a foreclosure? From 2014 to 2021, 8,600 homes and more than $780 million in savings were lost to this practice, known as home equity theft. We are working to end home equity theft everywhere it remains on the books. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to join the effort to protect property rights.
The Todd Alba Show.
Pat Kreitlow, all your time in the media, television, radio, what have you, what was one or two of the oddest things that people were complaining about?
As a TV anchor, your hair.
You have some of the finest hair around. How could anybody criticize your hair?
Oh, well, because a consultant forced me to change it.
Were there focus groups?
I'm not aware of any focus groups other than the audience, which universally hated it. It was a bowl haircut.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Dom Salvia Show.
Dr. Susan Webb Yackey, what advice would you give everyone who has an opportunity to engage in conversation with folks and sometimes we don't think alike?
One state of mind is to be curious about it. How did you come to that point of view? And the other is humility. This idea that we don't have all the answers.
I know.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Well, welcome back, and we're just beginning our conversation with Andrew Heaton, who's a great political podcast host on a podcast called The Political Orphanage. He's done a lot of comedy work. He's written a whole bunch, and he and I think share a lot of sort of similar framing of how we think this election goes. So if
I'll even add to that, Scott. You were kind enough to come on my program, The Political Orphanage, and you think so similar to me that it kind of freaked me out. And at one point, I began postulating that you might be me from the future who'd come back to talk to me in the past. It was very unnerving.
Well, we can probably sell that as a pilot to CBS or somebody.
Yeah, I like that. Time-traveling pundits, yeah.
So there's sort of two framing things you have to do in elections. Well, there's actually three. I mean, if you and I are running against each other, I have to define you. Right. And then I have to define who I am. And then the third thing is you have to figure out what issues you're running on. And sometimes that's good for you and sometimes it's bad for you. And I think the problem for Harris is going to be as we get closer to those undecided voters, it's people who weren't thrilled with what the economy's looked like the last 4 years. And I think I'm not a fan of the former president, as anybody who listens to this show knows. But I just think at the end of the day, it's people who are still worried about the cost of gas, the cost of bread, about taking their kids to McDonald's, about canceling a summer vacation. I think those folks are going to look and say, wow, Trump's really a strange guy, but it was better than he was president.
That could be the case. I mean, I think one of the other things that Kamala is doing that is a strategic decision that may or may not benefit her is she's intentionally trying to remain a kind of Schrodinger's candidate, where when she ran in 2020, as Trump has pointed out multiple times, she ran as a very progressive candidate and then flamed out before Iowa. Whereas now she has tacked much more to the center and is emphatically in favor of fracking and all of the things that more centrist Democrats would favor. When I was at the Democratic National Convention last month, it was lots of really good vibes. Everybody was really happy. The AOC wing of the party was really happy with her. They were thrilled with Tim Walz. The Obama free trade wing of the party liked her. Everybody liked her. And so she had a kind of internal rationale not to cease being a quantum candidate and really define herself because she'd alienate one wing or the other. And she's kind of started doing that because she's released some policy papers, so you can now actually get a feel for what she's allegedly going to do. But I think she's kind of playing that same card at the general election. And I do think it'll help in terms of the people that are just going off of vibes because they're just going to see a fresh face and go, I don't know, let's try a new one. In terms of the economy, you might have a point there. The polls indicate that people associate Trump with a better economy. I have a lot of qualms with that in that I am very much in favor of free trade and think tariffs are stupid. So I have a lot of problems with his economic model. But that seems to be earned or unearned the benefit that he gets. He gets like a +5 in economy.
Yeah, which is interesting. And then the other issue, which isn't hot for her either, is immigration. And so that's why I think she did a marvelous job in the debate making the case for the case against the Republicans on abortion, which I thought was really the high moment of the campaign. And now let's talk about the low moment of the campaign. People eating pets and casseroles in Ohio, which seems, you know, I appreciate the fact that CBS fact checked it, but did you really need to fact check that?
That, all right, there's two ways we can look at American politics going forward. We can either be very sad or we can find it very funny. I've decided to find it very funny. I have decided to treat this more like a sitcom than a Black Mirror episode. And looking at it with the sitcom analysis, I thought that whole moment was very funny because the precipitating moment to that was Kamala obviously baiting Donald Trump in a way that you could see from a million miles away, where I don't remember what the actual thing they were discussing was. Probably it wasn't the border. It was something else, the economy. I don't know. And she went, I invite people to watch a Trump rally, because what you will find is that people leave early because they find it boring and exhausting. And I saw that and I was like, there's no, like, any other political candidate would go, well, that's just, you know, like that's not really pertinent to what we're discussing here. But Trump could not, like, no, in a million years, Trump cannot let that go. So he immediately had to come back with, like, our rallies are amazing. And then after that, he was so addled, that's when he stepped into the they're eating cats line. And yes, I think the weird analysis that I have been seeing of the debate is where a lot of the pro-Trump people are saying, you know, the moderators were fact-checking Trump much harder than Kamala Harris. And I'm like, yes, I agree on that. However, the whole they shouldn't have fact-checked him as hard on immigrants are eating cats line, to me, is just not a really good strategy. I was saying, like, if only they hadn't fact-checked him on that, he'd be doing okay. I don't think so.
But the flip side of that, and I thought CBS really, or excuse me, ABC did a pretty good job and tried to balance it. And I think the mics being muted, while it didn't make for as much street theater, at least you got to hear what people were saying rather than it's my turn to talk. But I was troubled by the fact they asked one question about her policy flips. She answered it on fracking without pushing her. And then they never went back to the other stuff, which I thought let her off far too easy. And that bothers me. I mean, I generally, as somebody who spent 14 years in journalism, still spend lots of time on the journalism board at Northwestern University. I find a lot of the coverage, unfortunately, skewed. Do you agree with me on that?
Wholeheartedly, yes. I know you played board games when you were in high school, Scott. Did you ever play Dungeons and Dragons by chance?
I wasn't that weird. I played Risk and games in a couple
of times. Nice. I was a big Risk guy. In D&D, you've got character attributes, and you'll roll your character attributes of how strong you are and how smart you are. And in American politics, Republicans just kind of get a +5 automatically on the economy, and they get a +5 on defense. And Democrats just get like a +10 on integrity from the media. Like, they just, you by virtue of being a Democrat, you automatically get kind of a soft glove there. I didn't think that the moderators were in the can for Kamala. But I agree. I think, generally speaking, that the people that are running those debates are probably trying to be even-handed, but they're personally very invested in Trump losing, and as a result, they're overzealous in fact-checking him. And I think that goes back to, like, Romney and Obama. I don't disagree with that. I think that the media scrutiny is a lot harder. It's arguably one of the benefits of Trump, because I'm also not a Trump guy, but one of the benefits of Trump is that I think he actually compels journalists to do their job. When Biden, like, I as a, like, turn your head and squint level journalist, like, I could technically be a journalist depending on how you're looking at me. I view myself as in a positive adversarial relationship with politicians, the same way that a prosecutor is in a positive adversarial relationship with a defense attorney. There's an emergent order that comes out of the system by virtue of both parties squaring off against each other. So I don't want to take the position of just liking people in power from one side and disliking the other. I think we should always be putting pressure on them. And when Biden won the last election, the fact checker for CNN just went on vacation. And I looked at that and was like, but this is the exact time that you should be fact checking the incoming guy when he's like, this is the time to really. But the attitude was the threat is over. The threat is over. we can all go home now. And yes, I think that that becomes a big problem with legacy media.
Well, and I think there's a big problem with legacy media, too, in terms of diversity, right? You saw the big kerfuffle when one of the NPR editors quit because when he did a check of where his fellow reporters were registered, you can do that at the political rolls in Virginia and Washington and Maryland because it's all a public record. There were no Republicans. It was 93-0. And famously, you know, in the study that was done by Nate Silver, it was only 6% of journalists self-identified as Republicans. So not that they're making things up, but it would help if they had a little different perspective and didn't think the world would be solved by five more government programs.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. The Trump administration rolling out its deportation agenda in President Trump's first week in office, releasing numbers showing more than 500 arrests made within a 24-hour period following raids in major cities. ABC's Martha Raddatz has more.
ICE raids and arrests in cities across the country, Boston, New York, and Newark, New Jersey. Newark's mayor saying agents raided a small business without a warrant, detaining American citizens in the process.
People were fingerprinted, pictures of their IDs and face were taken there. When I got this information, I was appalled.
President Trump in Las Vegas today. He'll rally supporters and highlight his campaign promise on ending federal taxes on tips. Growing concerns over bird flu and its impact on egg production. Prices for eggs keep rising due to outbreaks at facilities. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Bucks head west. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks open a four-game road trip. Tonight they're in L.A. against the Clippers. Following that, games in Utah, Portland, and San Antonio. Men's college basketball, Marquette with another win over Villanova. 87-74 last night in Milwaukee. The Golden Eagles have never lost to Villanova since Shaka Smart took over as Marquette's head coach. The Badgers host Nebraska tomorrow at noon at the Kohl Center. NFL conference championships. First the Eagles and the Commanders at 2, followed by the Chiefs and the Bills. Quarterback Josh Allen hoping to lead the Bills back to a Super Bowl for the first time since Jim Kelly was the quarterback back in 1994.
You always remember the feeling of not pulling through. You know, that sticks with you for a while, and it really doesn't leave. But again, I think every year that you go through in this league, you learn more things about yourself, about your team, about the game of football. We look at that, and you know, we just love the opportunity that we have.
That's the Bills' Josh Allen. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Joe Montana here. In my football days, I knew the importance of a strong defense. Now I'm sharing how you can help defend your health against pneumococcal pneumonia and invasive pneumococcal disease.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny today, highs in the low 30s, slight chance of a light snow shower. It'll be a bit breezy from time to time out of the west. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 7, wind chills slightly below 0. Sunny and 29 for Sunday, but breezy again.
Currently 33 degrees.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Haller House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people, swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Carmelo Anthony for the Bail Project.
Bad news, you've been arrested. Good news, you're innocent until proven guilty. If you can pay your bail, good news, you go home to wait your trial. If you can't, sorry, you go to jail to wait. But sure, you still presumed innocent. But since you can't afford bail, you've lost your freedom. That's not right. And that's why the Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting the end cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Where are you at with dome stadiums?
Oh, love them. Snow games are awesome, but it's also a risk of injuries and everything.
Give me a dome anytime. I don't want to see elite athletes running on snow like it's me playing out there and tripping and slipping. I want to watch those guys run. I want the receivers to run and catch their passes. I want to see great athletes being great athletes.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Pete Hegseth.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey, folks, I'm Charlie Behrens. This is the Cripescast. You're listening to Civic Media. And here's my conversation with filmmaker Nathan Demming. And so you go out there and right away, did you just start working on your own film, or did you get a job and then start doing that on the side? Like, for people who are kind of interested in going out and doing it, what sort of a pathway that they could find?
Oh man, I don't even know what I'd say now, because it's just it's changed so much. And do you still live in LA, or are you mainly in Wisconsin now?
I lived there two periods in my life, but I moved back to Wisconsin in like 2018 or something like that.
Yeah.
Then I kind of had a place out there, my buddy's place, that I would go, and I had my stuff for like another 2 years. But then during COVID, I just was over it. So,
well, that's the thing. I think COVID changed the city so much. I mean, it's been a brutal time for the film industry there, for not necessarily for the studios. They're still making a lot of money, but if you've been reading the news this year, there's a lot of articles about people like fleeing Hollywood and like the below the line people, which is really depressing. So I don't know what the best thing is right now. Yeah, they should move out there, because when I moved there, it was 2014. Tons of stuff still shooting. You know, it was very easy to get on a film set and network and meet people. But most people I know now are out of work back in LA. And the ones that are like very like count your blessings, very happy, you know, for the work. I don't know what advice I would give people right now.
Let's talk about that. Like, what has created the changes in the film industry? Obviously, social media has sort of changed the game of where people are consuming videos, and a lot of people are going more short form in that regard. But when it comes to film, what has happened to the industry since 2014 that's made it much more difficult?
Yeah, I'd be interested on your thoughts too. But I mean, just since COVID, there's been huge changes to the industry. I mean, first of all, COVID completely obviously interrupted the production pipeline, right? And I think people outside the industry don't always know how long a movie takes, because whenever a movie shows up, it always feels so immediate and fresh, and as if, you know, it just popped, it just popped into the director's head and is now in front of you. But they probably started writing it 5 years before, you know, and then it didn't even get into production until 2 years later, 3 years later. And so anyways, all the production got slowed down. Then we had multiple strikes, which were all important, but, you know, also I think affected the amount of, work getting done. And they thought after the strikes, they thought things would kind of rebound, and they haven't yet. And there's the looming threat of AI. There's the already present threat of streaming. And like you mentioned, like YouTube Shorts and TikTok, maybe, if it sticks around, I guess. We don't know yet. Yeah, there's just so many changes. And I think some of it's really exciting. Like, my film probably looks a lot better for the budget we had than if I had made it 20 years ago, you know, because we were able to shoot on really good digital cameras that have streamlined a lot of the process. Where like, even, well, yeah, 20 years ago, even 30 years ago, it would have been like this whole nother skill set of technicians and people that would need to be involved, because you'd be shooting on actual film, you know. So there's opportunity, but I think things are just changing so much. And then on top of it, there's more indie filmmakers than ever selling to distributors. So I don't know, it's changed a lot, and there's opportunity, but also like I think everybody, even the studios, are like kind of like what's the right way forward right now. I mean, there were as many bombs as hits last year, right? Like, there were gigantic hits, and then a lot of movies that made no money.
Yeah, and you bring up a few things in there, and one of them is sort of technology, and it's a double-edged sword. It's easier for you to shoot on a lower budget, but on the other side of it, it's hard to know, like, where to invest your money today that's going to be effective in 2 years when the film actually comes out. Taking into effect AI, a lot of the strikes you mentioned centered around artificial intelligence and its role in the entertainment industry. What is your viewpoint on AI and how it's going to affect movies?
Oh, man. I mean, there's those doom and gloom people that are predicting that, like, instead of going to bed, turning on Netflix, that maybe you could turn on Netflix Plus. Well, you know what? I want to see Lord of the Rings with Star Wars characters, da, 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 or something. You know what I mean? And then suddenly this is the future, right? It's not right now, but suddenly AI makes you some movie. That's interesting. Who knows? I mean, it's already like I just remember 3 years ago, the first AI art was coming out. I think it was the first DALL-E thing. And it was, I don't know if you guys remember, it was like, it was pretty silly looking, the results, you know, and now you can still tell it's AI, but it's getting better. I mean, that's just in a couple of years. So I have no idea. I still think, and I hold on to the hope that art is the most interesting between humans and not between just some digital thing. That's like, cause I'm not if I'm creating my own movie like that, like not me, the filmmaker, but me as like, I'm laying in my bed and like, got AI Netflix on or something like that in the future. It's not necessarily giving me anything new, right? Where like, I think that's what the best artists do is they challenge you. And like David Lynch, who just passed, I mean, I can't imagine some AI coming along who has as much, you know, intuition or things to say about the human condition. I don't know. Do you think it'll change things or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really brings into the question of what makes humans sort of special, I guess, and what when you have sort of an entity that takes in these large language models, taking all the language that's ever been written and sort of spits out another creation of that in various ways, you kind of say, what do humans have that machine doesn't have? And that would be kind of like those things like a soul, a will, you know, like love, those kinds of aspects. And really good films have those and have those front and center. And so I think it's like, how will people demand that though? And I think the more we get taken into these sort of machines and sort of sucked into our phones, you can see it all over culture. We've sort of become a little bit less human and a little bit more robotic, just kind of always being sucked into those screens. So I'm hoping that people will kind of like realize that and still prefer those very human qualities and push it. I also think we're going to be fighting against the very human urge for things to be immediate and quick and path of least resistance. So it will be interesting. I don't have any real answers on it. But, you know, I just think it will come down to people demanding that we still have humanity in all this technology.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's kind of Brave New World, right? And like, I'd still prefer, I mean, January and February that I just made, not all the films are going to have this theme, but they both have themes and characters like with loneliness, you know, I don't know what place AI is going to be in to know that or resonate with that, you know? And then also the other difference I was thinking of while you're mentioning is we have bodies, right? We have a physical presence in the world that is shaped by our surroundings, and our lives are often responding to it too, which is another thing I want to explore with this time format, just because our environment affects us and it affects the art we make. You know, if somebody you love dies, if you fall in love, you know, all these things, that's where a lot of art comes from. It's just hard to picture what meaningful art will come from at the end of the 21st century when they look back. Are they going to be citing, oh, and then ChatGPT wrote the best book of the century? I don't know. It's hard to picture that happening.
Yeah, I know that's a little. Yeah, that's just kind of tough to think about right there. But, you know, you look at even things in your film, you know, when your main character is just sitting there, you talk about loneliness and he's super into his phone. And then what finally breaks him of that is seeing the ice fishing stuff and then finding this and having that very real connection with his other ice fishing buddy. You know, I think that shows a lot of hope for humanity in this sort of world where we are lonely. And so we turn to technology for those quick dopamine hits, you know. So it's cool that you showcase that in your film, and hopefully that's, you know, the way people go. I think the inherent problem is that the kind of like little robots, we have a hard time seeing what's happening to us because we're so distracted by the thing that's doing it to us. You know, we're always on our phone and therefore seeking out that quick dopamine hit, and therefore we're not able to observe that. Like if you go to the gym or something, it's like a bunch of people walking around in silence because they all have their headphones on. You know, it's sort of it's a little scary, but how many of us are pulling back to observe that is happening because we're also so distracted?
Well, that was another jumping off point for at least these two films, was just the way community has changed in my lifetime, because January is set in a church I grew up in. I'm not really religious now, but I have a lot of affection for this like friendly Midwest church I grew up in. And when I was a kid, it was thousands of people. And now I think might be less than 100, you know what I mean? And it's not because the town shrank or anything. And I mean, part of that's just people leaving the religion and stuff. But I think a huge part of it is like a lot of our lives are just, moving online. And a couple of years ago, I was substitute teaching for a little bit and noticing completely different world than the high school I went to. You know what I mean? Like, because the kids, they'll have these things in, you know, they'll have AirPods in or their phones. And I just can't imagine, like, because I've felt it in my life how, kind of separating it is, right? Like, you go to the gym, you don't talk to anybody. Or you can, whatever. You know, it's just different. It's all different. And I guess we're still learning about how to balance all these things.
I think it will just take very deliberate it's going to take deliberate choices on behalf of people to maintain humanity. It's going to be the deliberate choice to do that, because the path of least resistance is we're going to transform. We are like the caterpillar, you know, and we're going to just become a bunch of AI butterflies. That might be, that's what it seems like, dude.
Yeah, that might be.
And that seems like a very natural way for this progression. I don't know. There's some wild stuff, like, you can kind of go deep down the rabbit hole on, but I think the bottom line is, like, we have to decide if we like humans and humanity and embrace that intentionally, because the money is going to go the other way, and the forces that be are pushing us that way. So,
well, that's another reason I want to do this series over 15 years or so, right? Like, we're in such kind of crazy times in a million ways, like what we're just describing politically, you know, culturally. I'm really interested to find what does stick, you know what I mean, over the years, what stories or just aspects of our lives don't change. Cause that's usually like the books and movies I like. They're from completely different time periods, often in the same kind of upheaval or confusion, but there's something there that's universal, you know, that keeps you like, you know, why do we read Pride and Prejudice? You know, it's like 200 years ago in a completely different world, but I guess the themes are, you know, relevant enough.
Yeah, definitely. And what's sort of your timeline for, you said over the next 15 years, so you're working on March right now?
Yeah, I have March written. Some a hopeful plan to actually get that one shot by the end of the year. But I'm also, I'm kind of really focused on this feature now. So that's the idea, is that no matter what else I'm doing in my career, I can always come back, hopefully every other year, every few years, make one of these month films and hopefully get Wisconsin audiences into it.
That's cool. What lake did you guys shoot on?
Lake Altoona in Eau Claire.
Oh, and, yeah. Nice.
That was... We haven't talked much yet about Richie, who he plays the ice fisherman. He found him on Craigslist. He's not an actor. And he's like,
was that his truck too?
No, that we did rent that truck, but the fishing gear is mostly his. Like, I was getting ready to rent fishing gear, and then he's like, I got all this stuff. And I was like, okay, we'll just use that. And, but he was so funny because we were shooting on Altoona and he kept going, there's this crappy fish in this lake. There's nothing here. And I was like, it's a movie, man. People don't need to know we're actually filming on Lake Altoona. But and that was, I don't know if you've ever, have you done any videos or anything out on the ice where you've had like cars and stuff out there?
Yeah, yeah. I was actually just out on Winnebago the other day, and I was about a mile out on the ice, 3 miles out, actually.
It's kind of surreal, right? It's like, especially when you have like the film attitude, you know what I mean? Because that set life or whatever you want to call it, set culture, sometimes makes things feel like you're not really there or you're not in danger of things. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
At the same time, you have to plan for like, no, this is all very real. We're standing and the truck is parked on 2 feet of ice, which I'm told is very safe. But at the same time, we have to be worried about everybody. And if it goes in, what do we possibly do on a small indie film, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure your insurance senses were tingling quite a bit there.
Yeah, yeah.
So you must have shot it. We haven't had good ice in Wisconsin for years. So you must have shot it, what, three years ago?
No, 2 years ago. Because last year was the, I heard, because I was back in LA, that was like the really bad winter, right?
Yeah.
I didn't realize how lucky I got shooting. I think it was 2023, February. Yeah, we got lucky with the...
Oh, yeah, you got very lucky. Because yeah. I don't think that ice lasted too long that year, if I remember correctly.
Well, even by the end of the shoot, we were filming in like exteriors in the city. And it got up to 50 randomly, you know? So
Yep, it'll do that. We broke the weather. But, and then did you guys actually catch a trout in that lake?
No comment. That's movie magic right there. What happened there?
I was like, I didn't know that they had trout in there. That's fun. So, but yeah, the idea of bringing all, an entire crew out there on the, how long was that shoot? Was that just for a night?
Well, we had multiple days. I mean, the inside the ice fishing tent is in a garage, right? Like we did that. We were smart about that. But we still had to set it up. We had exteriors with that. We had all the driving scenes. We had, you know, the drilling and stuff. And multiple days. And then we got out there and we, you know, had all this worry about it, all this like extra precautions. And then we're out there. And for a minute, I was like looking through the viewfinder and I was like, it looks like we're in the middle of a field, you know. Will people know or care that this is like a real lake? And of course, you know, once the auger goes through and you see like water come up, you know, but yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you probably could have faked it. But yeah, people I think definitely your ice fishermen would definitely know. Yeah, they'd be able to spot that.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's very cool. So and then you said you're working on a feature right now. What's the feature you're working on?
Sorry, I can't mention it yet because I'm trying to we're trying to secure financing and I'm not supposed to talk about it. Which
no worries.
It sounds lame of me to say, but that's the state it's in. So yeah,
I get it. I noticed in February that you had a few different brands like in there. Like you shot, I think there was a Quick Trip in there. I think there was a shot of a Quick Trip.
There's Quick Trip. Yeah. Well, we have that one. We have a shot too. That's kind of like that meme of all the signs. You know, it's like Subway. McDonald's. You know, yeah. No, there was no sponsorship. I just,
okay.
film the reality of what you know. That's the other change in my lifetime. I feel like at least in Tomah was kind of a thriving small city in its own way. And then over 20 years, the Walmart got built by the interstate, and then like this explosion of just chains that, and then everything just got sucked there and
yeah,
things got closed down. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of the, again, you know, that's sort of the path of least resistance always follows the money. So it's like making deliberate choices in order to sort of keep like the culture and all that there and present. So, which is what you're doing with this film. And where can people see it through the month of February?
So we're going all over Wisconsin. If you go to februaryfilm.com/screenings, that's our like our full roster, but we're hitting up everywhere. We're hit Richland Center, nice. Alma, Oshkosh, Appleton, Madison, Milwaukee. Like we're going everywhere. I tried to fill out as much of the state as I could. And I'm actually really excited for the smaller screenings because I found so many cool older theaters like Stanley, Wisconsin. We're having a screening. It's like this great old town theater that's been family owned for like 50 years. So it's been kind of a fun part of it too. But yeah, all our screenings are there. They're all free. I'm going to be at all of them, getting people psyched about the month of February, ice fishing, and hopefully also provoking a little conversation about, like Latinos in our state and their contributions. Like, in our, we're kind of having a big premiere in Eau Claire on the 1st, and that Q&A is also going to be kind of a talk shared by a professor, a Latino professor from UW Eau Claire. So that should be really fun.
Oh, very cool, man. Is the film finished and finalized?
All done. Yeah. So
nice.
Going out there. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. And what's that process like? Like, do you have to submit it to the place X amount of, months before in order to get it on four screen four walled?
Well, this is kind of new to me. I mean, the normal path you do is film festivals, right? And that is a process that I think people also don't know. It's like that takes years. It takes like 6 months to hear back from a film festival, and then they have rolling admissions throughout the year, and then it's this whole thing. And we already did some film festival screens and had a great time at the Wisconsin Film Festival. But I was really excited about the one limitation of a film festival is that it's really exciting. It's really fun. And then you get there and maybe like a couple hundred people see it, you know? So I'm excited about this process of actually bringing it to people. And I'm mildly inspired by / stealing an idea from Hundreds of Beavers, which I know you know that film.
Yeah.
They did this too. I have a very different film. I'm not expecting the same reaction. But what they did, I think, is really smart and a really new thing. I mean, it's old but new, which is that, you know, if you want to connect with audiences, you can totally do this. You can just take your film around and meet people. And the technology's changed so much that now on my laptop, I can prepare the actual file a cinema would need, you know, like it's just all there for you now. So yeah, but to answer your question, I was surprised too at how easy it was once people, I just sent cinemas the film, or like kind of cool, like in La Crosse, we're playing at the Pump House, which is this like art center. We're doing a couple of those too. And just hearing back from them and their enthusiasm was cool. And then just setting it up in a way to make it easy for people to come. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, man. I appreciate you coming on. This was very fun.
No, thanks for having me, man. Really nice to meet you. And thanks for shouting out our film.
Absolutely. All right. That is it for now, guys. But make sure you go check out February. It starts playing in theaters around Wisconsin January 25th. To see if there's a screening near you, you can get tickets februaryfilm.com/screenings. And you can also follow Nathan on Instagram. That's at Nathan.Deming. And if you're interested in learning more about Action Wisconsin and their mission to get a film office and production tax incentives in Wisconsin, visit actionwi.org. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Colleen Maraca and Hannah Milos for producing and editing. Everyone, keep her moving and watch for deer.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down. Just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin. Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome comedian and founder of Chip's Money Tips, Chip Chinnery, and filmmaker Nathan Deming, who is touring Wisconsin to promote his film February. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Luke Mathers joins us now.
The Bucks were playing, the Badgers were hosting Minnesota, and I couldn't get either of those games on YouTube TV.
Years later, they're going to look back at this and go, oh my God, how did you guys get through it? I mean,
things don't happen in a vacuum, though, and you have to elect people that will break up these giant monopolies and allow us to watch our favorite teams in peace.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow, weekday morning 6 until 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us. Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. The Senate confirmed Kristi Noem today to lead Homeland Security Department. The weekend session comes on the heels of last night's tie-breaking vote confirming Pete Hegseth as Defense Secretary. Senators reacting to word that President Trump fired 17 inspectors general late Friday night without giving the required 30-day notice to Congress. Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
One more example of a lack of respect for rule of law. I mean, we saw it earlier when President Trump pardoned all the January 6th rioters, now to get rid of independent inspector generals. How is any of this going to lower grocery prices?
GOP Senator Chuck Grassley says he's also waiting for an explanation. Four Israeli soldiers have been returned to Israel, held hostage by Hamas since the October 7th attacks. It's the second exchange in the Gaza ceasefire deal. 200 Palestinians also released. This is ABC News.